a good movie, but a lot of people like him for the reason. Anyways, so the music is done now, and now it's just me. I hope you've enjoyed the show. And I hope you've enjoyed me as a host. Lord knows I don't deserve it. And I don't even mean that in one of those ways where they say it like Regis Philbin after years on the air is like, hey, I know I've been great. I know that you all love me, but...
You say it as in, like, it's literally not your
It's show. Literally like, you don't want me here. Please kick me out.
Yeah.
Hey, don't worry about that. But yeah, I'm gonna miss recording a show here and doing a show here. The show's pre-recorded. If you call in, oh, shout out the best MTG Mill Popper Infect player in Pittsburgh, Miles Hartledge. Woo! I'll see you. Yeah, I'm recording the show a day early, so I'll see you in like an hour probably. Bye, 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 everybody. Bye, bye. Bye. I love you. Bye. Bye. Sorry about the curse words.
Don't say that.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hello, and welcome to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. Today we have Dr. Etta Fields Black, who's a professor of history here at CMU and who just won the Pulitzer for her book, Combi. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Could you take a moment to introduce yourself, what you do here, and what other stuff I may not have mentioned yet?
Sure. So I am a professor in the Department of History, and I teach courses on Africa and the African diaspora, which includes the Middle Passage, pre-colonial courses on pre-colonial African history, modern African history, the Middle Passage of West African history through film. I also direct the Dietrich College Humanities Center.
So I asked you here to talk today because you did just win the Pulitzer Prize. Can you tell us a little about your book and about the Combahee River Raid?
Sure. So the book is about what happened on June 1st through 3rd, 1863. June 1st, about 9 p.m., Harriet Tubman and her group of spies, scouts, and pilots piloted Colonel James Montgomery, who was the commander of the raid, up the Combahee River in three armed U.S. gunboats. And aboard were the 2nd South Carolina Volunteers, about 300 black soldiers, and the 3rd Rhode Island Heavy Artillery, one battery of white soldiers. They burned 7 rice plantations in 6 hours, and all the buildings, the stables, the plantation owners' homes, the barns that had the previous year's rice crop in it. They opened the floodgates in the rice fields and destroyed the rice crop that was currently growing there. They burned a bridge at Combahee Ferry, which would prevent the Confederate planters from trading rice, exporting it, as well as using it to feed Confederate citizens and the Confederate military. And they freed 756 people. And I argue in Combahee that this was the largest slave rebellion in U.S. history, largest and most successful, and second only to the Haitian Revolution in the history of the New World.
Wow. That's really cool. I also heard you found a family connection to that history.
I did. And a lot of people think that I assume that I wrote the book because my great-great-great-grandfather fought in the raid. And no.
No?
I actually learned this in the process of researching the book. I was looking for him and trying to find out more information about the Fields family at the time that I was starting the book. And so there are connections to the research, but I didn't set out to write a book about him and didn't really know the details. There's still more that we don't know, but I didn't know much besides his name and the name of his son, and father to son down to my great grandfather. I didn't know much about him before I started writing the book.
That makes sense, because from my understanding, this is a pretty hidden history, which is why it's so awesome that you're bringing it to light.
Thank you so much.
So how did you do the research for this? Because I assume it's not as easy as, you know, going down and flipping open other books and learning all about it.
No, it's not. So I was really surprised that so little had been written about the raid and so little had been written about Harriet Tubman's Civil War service. And I think in large part that's because it's not her service, her leadership is not recorded in the official military record, which to me is not surprising. And what it meant is that I had to look in other places. So I started, and where I found much of the information about Tubman that, you know, historians didn't know before, came from the letters of abolitionists. Mm. Abolitionists who, with whom Tubman had been in community before the Civil War broke out, after she liberated herself, when she became part of abolitionist networks in Philadelphia, Massachusetts, and upstate New York. And so in the letters of some abolitionists who came down to Beaufort, Port Royal, and the Sea Islands after a big battle in Beaufort called the Battle of Port Royal in November of 1861, I was able to find them writing letters home about Harriet Tubman and what she was doing. And it was often not the abolitionists themselves, but their children. Wow. So William Lloyd Garrison's son, for example, and Frederick Douglass's son, both of whom joined the military. Garrison was in the 55th Massachusetts. Douglass was in the 54th Massachusetts. Both of them were stationed in the area. They encountered Harriet Tubman and they wrote about her. So these were young people who grew up with Tubman, and they volunteered after this Battle of Port Royal to come down as the freedom seekers were adjusting to freedom. And they encountered Harriet Tubman and they wrote about them. For the freedom seekers, and I wanted very much to tell the story of the Cumbie River Raid through the people who were impacted by it, particularly the enslaved people who were liberated in it. And I found those sources at the National Archives, the U.S. Civil War pension files. So I'm using their testimony in the pension files to tell their side of the story.
Do the pension files have what they have to say about things as opposed to what the other people would have to say then?
They are very underused. And in the files, people testify about the raid. They also testify about their families. They testify about community life, courting and weddings and childbirth, going to church and people who were not going to church and had gotten put out of the church for all kinds of modern behavior, like living with people with whom they were not married. So they talk about, you know, real life, and they talk about it in a way that historians had not seen. You don't see this in the historical literature of slavery, right? To hear people who were born and raised in bondage tell their own stories. And when I say raised, people who, you know, were not free until they were adults. So they spent much of their lives in bondage. We had not heard their stories. And so it is a very, the pension files, U.S. Civil War pension files, are definitely an underutilized resource.
So in terms of Cumbie, you were focusing on telling the story through the eyes of enslaved people. And I know you've also worked on other stuff like Requiem for Rice, which is like symphonic. So how does this working in interdisciplinary and multimedia works affect the way you kind of tell history?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I have worked with both artists and scientists, and worked with the scientist really to find interdisciplinary sources to tell the stories of people who didn't leave written documents. So in the case of peasant rice farmers in pre-colonial West Africa, right, using archaeology and soil science and biological and botanical studies of mangroves in order to find out how peasant rice farmers developed their mangrove rice technology. And then I work with artists to translate this research into broader audiences, really, and to translate it into artistic mediums, which will appeal to broader audiences, more people than would ever read my books, my previous books at least,
Yeah, I hope a lot of people are reading this one.
to come be selling like hotcakes, but that's another story. to really bring this research to life, and to find a way to communicate it so that people can really empathize with enslaved people and see them as humans and see them as, I say, mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers, aunties, uncles, cousins, sweethearts, and baby mamas, to see them as just everyday people, which I don't think is a way that we have been able to see enslaved people in the past.
Would you say that you work even in your books in terms of trying to bring it to a broader audience, or are they more of an academic thing and then you spread them out through your symphonic works or your librettes or stuff?
Yeah, so my previous two books were written for academic audiences. Cumbie is written for a general audience and published by a trade press. And so what I found is that working with the scientists and working with the artists, and sometimes I would be in the rice fields with both the scientists and the artists, and that was more fun than one should be allowed to have. that's transformed the way I write history, and it's transformed the audience for which I want to write history. So it's no longer just an audience of academics, right? I want to write for academics and I want my work to be well, highly regarded by academics, but I also want to write for the general public. I want the general public to feel like they are a part of this history too.
Yeah, and it's a heavy history. Is there any way that you deal with going through all of that and writing about it? Because that seems intense.
Yeah, it was quite intense. There are a lot of emotions that come up in reading these documents, primary source documents from the time, which are detailing what enslaved people endured. And my goal was always, first of all, to experience the emotions myself. And then to try to translate them, to try to channel them in a way that, to try to channel them into the writing, right? Into the narrative, so that your average reader could experience what I experienced, what I felt, and could hopefully then empathize with enslaved people, could think about them, as I said, as people. Whose families were being torn apart, whose health and bodies were constantly being put in jeopardy and exploited, to create a commercial rice industry which was incredibly lucrative to the planters and the slaveholders, but which came at a great cost for the enslaved laborers.
I think you focus on the rice industry, which I think is interesting because when I think of, what they were teaching me in high school about enslavement, they were mostly talking about cotton plantations. Can you talk a little more about how rice played into that system?
So rice is another little told story. we know that the foundations of the rice technology that was used to create the commercial rice industry in coastal South Carolina and Georgia came from West Africa. So it was brought here by enslaved people who were from the Rice Coast region, which is Senegal in the north, down to Liberia. We know that growing rice for commercial purposes with enslaved labor totally transformed this technology. And it created a very deadly environment for enslaved people because rice is grown in water. And standing water breeds mosquitoes. And those mosquitoes carried malaria, right? Malaria was endemic to the region. So people who were enslaved on these plantations, their health was completely compromised. They suffered from chronic malaria, which didn't kill them, but shattered their immune systems to the point where children were born, babies were born, and many failed to thrive and died before their first birthday. And 2/3 of children who survived the first year didn't survive past their 15th year. And then even as adults with, you know, years and years and years suffering from chronic malaria, couldn't fight off things like respiratory illness, right? So people are dying from other illnesses. They're not dying from malaria, but because of chronic malaria, their immune systems can't fight these other illnesses. Just a very deadly environment with the highest death rate, second highest in the New World, only to sugar plantations in the Caribbean. So it's something that a lot of Americans, we don't know about because cotton is sort of king in the U.S. South. But rice is also extremely, extremely important.
Are there any other untold stories that you like to focus on?
Well, I'm looking for the next one. I'm giving Cumbie its due, but I am also thinking about my next project and sort of laying the groundwork for the next project. So I want to continue telling untold stories. I want to continue giving voice to people who have heretofore been voiceless, and exploring and finding new sources with which to tell their stories.
Yeah, that's really powerful. Do you have any ideas of what comes next, or is that still in the works?
Well, there is an art exhibit based on Cumbie that opens May 23rd. So there are no breaks here. Down in Charleston at the Gibbs Museum of Art, and it's called Picturing Freedom, Harriet Tubman in the Cumbie River Raid. I'm also in the very early stages of working with colleagues at CMU in information systems to create a portal through which we're going to crowdsource the transcriptions of a couple thousand U.S. Civil War pension files. And these files are this data set. Then we're going to use AI so that historians, genealogists, and family members can find out more information about individual enslaved people.
So in terms of AI, are there like new tools that you've been using lately that are coming out? Or are you still going through archives in an old library?
Well, both. I mean, I'm exploring AI with my colleagues so that I can just go through more. I transcribed with a team of research assistants, transcribed about 200 pension files, more than 200 pension files for Cumbie. And now we're looking at thousands, right? And so I want to... And I want other people to really be able to access the pension files and to be able to access the information that's in them so that we can rewrite the histories of slavery and the Civil War.
In terms of working with your colleagues, I know you work in the Department of History, and you also are the director of the Humanities Center. How does that play into your work?
Well, I think that, directing the Humanities Center, we are supporting faculty and graduate student research, original research, interdisciplinary, collaborative research. And all of this is what I do, having collaborated with scientists, artists, and now, the AI folks. And really supporting faculty in doing their amazing research, maybe doing more public-facing research if that's what they want to do, and just helping kind of break through the barriers that faculty run into in doing research in the humanities and making our work more visible. So, in many ways, I'm trying to empower more faculty to do things like I have done, very ambitious projects, which in my case are very public facing. And yeah, I'm trying to empower more faculty to do more of that kind of work.
So, in terms of your projects, you said companies selling like hotcakes, but is there anything that you worked on earlier in your career that you think people should pay a little more attention to?
Well, in my book Deep Roots, I'm also telling untold stories and looking for new sources to with which to tell them. So in that book, I'm using linguistic evidence and combining it with scientific evidence from particularly the botanical and biological studies of mangroves and different kinds of mangroves. I think it's a very interesting book. It's written for an academic audience, but it's all about endangered languages and recording endangered languages and using these endangered languages as a tool to tell the stories and reconstruct the history of people in coastal Guinea, West Africa, who also didn't leave written sources, and about whom many written sources by missionaries and slave traders and other kinds of traders were not really written. So, really trying to fill that gap in the historical literature.
That's really cool. So, in terms of the historical literature, it seems like a lot of it is written more by, as you said, missionaries or slave traders. Or, like, the stories that get written down are usually those of the people in power, maybe oppressing other people. How do you work with that when you're trying to tell your untold stories?
Well, some historians would disagree with me, but I don't throw those people in power out. What I do is I interrogate them as what I call hostile witnesses. And I try to, fully acknowledging their biases. And try to find what is of historical value in their accounts. I also try to balance them. I don't rely on them completely, as historians have done in the past. So I try to balance them with other voices, particularly the voices of the people that I'm writing about, right? So in this case, the voices of enslaved people, I want to hear them tell their stories. And they often don't tell them in written form. In the case of the Cumbie River Raid, they're testifying orally for these pension applications. But sometimes their evidence is in the land, right? And so this is what I did with my first book, which is Deep Roots, is to try to understand how these peasant farmers who didn't leave written sources, how they changed the land, right? How they changed the landscape. We can use the fruits of their labor, if you will, as a historical source. We can use the rice fields they built as historical sources.
I think that's so interesting to use a rice field as a historical source.
I use a rice field for everything.
How did you first start studying rice?
Well, I was interested, and this goes back to my first year in college. I was interested in the Gullah Geechee, who are African Americans and descendants of slaves from coastal South Carolina and Georgia. And they live on the sea islands. They live in the mainland, meaning the cities and towns, but they also live on the rice plantations, which are right on the interior of the coast. I was very curious about this language and culture because my father was born about 2 miles, 1 or 2 miles from where the raid took place. He's the last of his siblings born in the South Carolina Lowcountry before my grandparents migrated their family to Florida. First, they went to the capital city, which is not the capital, but the city, which is Charleston. And then they went down to Miami, Florida, where I was born and where my dad grew up. So I was curious about the dialect that my grandparents spoke because it was different than anything else I heard anywhere else, except when we went to visit my great-grandmother in coastal South Carolina. So that sparked my curiosity. And then, and I did a lot of reading about it as an undergraduate. And when I went to graduate school, was very interested in the Gullah Geechee and their West African connections. So how did West African languages and cultures influence what we call today the Gullah Geechee? And I chose rice as sort of the prism through which to look at that question. So that's how I got into studying rice, and I went to West Africa to begin my career, and then decided to write my second project on the other side of the Atlantic in the rice fields of coastal South Carolina and Georgia.
It's really cool that rice takes you all the way from West Africa to here to the Combahee River, right?
Yes, it does.
All right. Well, we're starting to go a little low on time. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
I could say that, you know, Combahee is the first time that Harriet Tubman's Civil War service has been documented. And so that's a very important part now of her legacy and an important impact of the book. And Combahee also is introducing the U.S. Civil War pension files as a third source that historians can use to hear the voices and tell the stories of enslaved people in their own words and formerly enslaved people. And it's the U.S. Civil War pension files are also a source that genealogists and family members can use. Millions of African Americans can use to identify our enslaved ancestors and to learn our family history and to pass it down to future generations.
Thank you so much. This has been Dr. Etta Fields Black on Forbes Avenue.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.
This is a production of PBRTV.com. In our 10th year, welcome to Smooth, Relaxing, and Easy with Eric O'Brien. Recorded at the PBRTV.com studios for Tube City Online Radio and WRCT Pittsburgh at 88.3 FM and WRCT.org.
lot of fa la 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 la's. That was the Dusty Tracy Singers on Smooth, Relaxing, and Easy with Deck the Halls. We started this show off with Bert Kempfert. I heard the bells on Christmas Day. I'm Eric O'Brien. Welcome to the second edition of the 2025 Christmas episodes of Smooth, Relaxing, and Easy. This is, of course, the last one of the season, but festive nonetheless, because we are just getting started with the Christmas season as it is written, because December 25th is the first day of Christmas. That being said, let's move on to the holidays of the day that nobody knows about, such as, December 26th, of course, in other countries is Boxing Day, widely noted in the U.S., but it's Return Day in the U.S. So return all those gifts that you didn't want or don't need or whatever. It's also National Candy Cane Day, because there are still candy canes everywhere. Nobody's stopping you. Just pop one in your mouth and enjoy. It's also National Thank You Note Day, which is a polite nudge to write or send thanks for all those gifts that you didn't want to have so that you celebrate Boxing Day. December 27th is National Fruitcake Day. It's a much maligned holiday loaf of fruit, nuts, and other such stuff. But it finally gets its moment of respect, but that's about it, because they'll save it for next year to celebrate again. And they won't eat it. Make cutout snowflakes day. Scissors, paper, and the joy of accidentally cutting the whole thing apart. Yes, yes. Don't cut on the fold, or rather, you do. I don't remember. Haven't done it. It's also visit the zoo day if it's warm enough to do so. But most zoos are open no matter where they are. It's a general reminder that animals like holiday attention too. December 28th is National Card Playing Day, so break out the deck for poker, rummy, or questionable family rules. National Chocolate Candy Day, because chocolate really needs another day. I mean, it doesn't even need a day for itself. It's also TikTok Day, and that's not the app on your phone. It's TikTok in terms of TikTok, 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 TikTok on your clock. Encourages reflection on the year as the clock runs out on the old year. December 29th, and this year it's TikTok Day Observed, so maybe you don't celebrate it on a Sunday, I don't know. It gets moved to Monday, continued reminder that time waits for no one. It's National Pepper Pot Day, celebrating the historic American stew dating back to colonial times. And it's Still Need to Do That Day, honoring unfinished to-do lists everywhere. That would take me several days to accomplish. December 30th is National Bacon Day. Of course it is. Why not? I mean, crispy, chewy, or however you want to have it. It's bacon. Enjoy it as you can. Falling Needles Family Fest Day, marking the moment Christmas trees start shedding aggressively, especially if you put it up on November 1st. Just keep it watered and moist. It's also Festival of Enormous Changes at the Last Minute, a Seinfeld-inspired day for sudden plans and surprises. Didn't know that one existed. Okay, December 31st is, of course, New Year's Eve in the evening, a night of reflection, countdowns, and debating whether midnight is worth staying up for. It's also National Champagne Day, so pop the cork and ring in the new year with bubbles. And it's also Make Up Your Mind Day, encouraging finally deciding anything before the year ends. And then finally, this time around, is January 1st, 2026. New Year's Day, of course, welcoming a new calendar and a hopeful resolutions. National Bloody Mary Day, because brunch beverages understand recovery, I guess. And it's also Polar Bear Plunge Day, celebrating the brave or even questionable tradition of icy swims to start the year. Most of those people are nuts. But those are the holidays of the day that you didn't know you needed to celebrate, but now you do, so you should celebrate them because you probably have time off from work. Here's Percy Faith and Joy to the World on Smooth, Relaxing, and Easy.
Santa has loaded his sleigh with warm, comforting Christmas music just for you.
Merry Christmas, everyone.
Happy holidays from Smooth, Relaxing, and Easy.
This is Smooth, Relaxing, and Easy. Evie Turnquist, at least she was when she recorded that. She is Evie Turnquist Carlson, but simply known as Evie, a Norwegian-American Christian singer who became popular in the 1970s. And with that clear, gentle voice, it helped bring contemporary Christian music to a wider audience. And she's received multiple awards over the years, and that's her rendition of Away in a Manger. Before that, Ronnie Aldridge with the Christmas Waltz, Percy Faith, Christmas Is, Ralph Carmichael and O Come All Ye Faithful, and Percy Faith in there again with Joy to the World. This is Christmas music on Smooth, Relaxing, and Easy, the second program of such this year, the last program of 2025, as a matter of fact, and next week we'll be back to the normal format here on Smooth, Relaxing, and Easy. Here is the Singers Unlimited and the Coventry Carol.
Lay the little tiny child by my newly Ooh.
In our 10th year, you're listening to Smooth, Relaxing, and Easy on Tube City Online Radio and WRCT Pittsburgh.